Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good to see all of you. Just wanted to pass on greetings once again from the folks in the Front Range congregations. They always like to hear the hello back, so I will assume you're giving one back. We're going to continue this volley as long as you're willing. Okay. Appreciate it. Do appreciate the sermonette topic. I was just thinking a lot as Bart was delivering that about truth. That God, when he declares something, I mean, even something as challenging as it was for them, where you have 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine, when he declares something, he keeps his promises. His word is truth. And it's something for which we can rely on. And as we're going to get into the sermon topic, you'll see how that ties in very tightly with what we're going to talk about here today. By way of further introduction, I just want to refer to an article that was posted in the UK section of the BBC News, actually just a short while ago, a few weeks. A gentleman by the name of Robert Pigeot, he's the religious affairs correspondent for the British Broadcasting Corporation. He had written this article, and it was titled, "Motion to End Bible Oaths in Court Defeated." Motion to End Bible Oaths in Court Defeated. Now, the article had referred to what is called the Magistrates Association. What they do is they deal with the judges and the protocols that the court system in England and Wales deals with. How they, in this particular case, debated a motion by one magistrate to replace how an oath is sworn in court by both witnesses and defendants. Now, perhaps we've all heard the phrase, or something like it, whether it be in television, or maybe we actually heard this in an actual courtroom, where someone says, I swear by Almighty God to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And how it's often done while either holding a Bible in their hand, or maybe even just placing their hand upon it. It's a very common thing we'd see. Well, this motion that they had here, again, with the Magistrates Association, it sought to replace that, the swearing of an oath, by asking the witness or defendant to simply promise to very sincerely tell the truth, just to promise to do that. Supporters of the motion argue that many people have become indifferent to the Bible, that swearing to God or to do so on a Bible no longer compelled people to tell the truth, no longer compelled them to do that. Rather, what needed to be done was a greater emphasis on how seriously lying in court is treated. You know, the penalties associated with perjury. Yeah, don't make them swear by God, but put the fear of God in them if they lie. Different angle. Well, the magistrates, the greater group of this, thought otherwise. They thought that referencing God and the Bible strengthened the witness's testimony, that its moral force placed a lot of pressure. Actually, they referred to intense pressure on the witnesses to tell the truth. So they did not agree. They did not agree, and this motion was defeated. Already the courts of England and Wales, they accommodate other things. For example, oaths can be taken on other books. Muslims, for example, on the Quran. Jews on the Old Testament, if that's what they prefer. And atheists are allowed to solemnly, sincerely, and truly affirm instead of swearing. They're allowed to do that. So in the courts of England and Wales, people will continue to swear an oath on the Bible should they choose to. And similarly, in the courts of the U.S., a witness or defendant is asked to swear that they will tell the truth. They may take a sacred oath that binds their conscience. For example, they could swear on a Bible. They can do that. Or they can choose to just affirm or promise to tell the truth without religious belief. So similar situation in the U.S. But you know, it's interesting. You know, we live in a world where it can be very challenging to get to the truth. Very challenging to get there. And all too often, the truth is the first casualty when people interact with one another. You know, we have an incredibly elaborate system of lawyers and contracts. We have notaries. We have binding signatures. We have all sorts of things like that to try to ensure that we do what we say we're going to do, at least when it's perceived to be important enough. But does any of it really compel anyone to be more truthful? Does it? Are they any more truthful? You know, one of the enduring themes we have in our Bibles is that we have truth. The concept of truth is found throughout Scripture. We read in places like John 17, verse 17, "Sanctify them by your truth." Your word is truth. It's truth. And truth matters. Truth matters a great deal, and we must know what our part is in the telling of it, and what our part is in holding to our promises. And with that in mind, then, for the sermon time that we'll spend here this morning, we're going to spend some time on a biblical framework for telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And specifically, we're going to do that in this context of just keeping our word, keeping our promises, that we are people of our word, and that matters to us. But more importantly, the truth should be, and as we're going to see here, should be at the very heart of who we are, the very heart of that. That truth is just an absolutely basic and fundamental characteristic of godly behavior and godly character that we display. It's very, very basic and very essential. Let's go ahead and begin by turning to Genesis chapter 28. Genesis 28, we will look at one of the ways that promises were often made. The form of them typically being that of vows and that of oaths. Here we're going to see an example that Jacob did in making a vow. So we're going to go to Genesis chapter 28, and we're going to read verses 20 through 22. Again, Genesis 28, 20 through 22. It says, "Then Jacob made a vow. He made a vow saying, 'If God will be with me and keep me in this way that I am going and give me bread to eat and clothing to put on, so that I come back to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God. And this stone which I have set as a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you.'" Now this word vow here is a Hebrew word. It's called nadar. Nadar. Spelled N-A-D-I-R if you want to write it down. But it means to promise. It means to promise to do or to give something to God. To do or give something to God. And when we speak of an oath, which is also referred to a lot in Scripture, it is also a promise. It's also a promise made between someone and someone else, between two, someone and another, shall I say. But a vow is special. The vow is special because it is also an oath. It is a promise, like an oath is, but this is entered between man and God. Between man and God, that's what a vow is. So again, a vow is a promise to God. Let's go ahead and now turn to Numbers chapter 30. Numbers chapter 30. And we'll look at the makings of what constitutes an oath or a vow and the obligations that will bring. Numbers chapter 30 and verse 2. That's what we'll read. It says, "If a man makes a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by some agreement, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth." Now, that's interesting here. The word swears and the word oath are actually the same word. They're the same word in Scripture. It's a Hebrew word called Shaba. Shaba. And it literally means to seven oneself. Seven being like the number seven. And the idea here is that seven is symbolic. It's symbolic of completion. It's symbolic of perfection. So basically it says, I'm promising a promise. Absolute. Promise a promise. And so again, the idea here is that the promise is complete, and the promise is without any question. And swearing an oath here is also an appeal. It's an appeal to God as a witness, that God is witnessing the truthfulness of what is being said, what is being promised, that the person here is declaring the truth, that they're declaring the truth, which of course means that swearing falsely was to represent God as supporting a statement that wasn't true, a false statement, or a lie. Of course, if that happened, that would be something we would need to repent of. But what happens when we invoke this particular thing, when we swear an oath, we make a declaration, God is witnessing that declaration. Now we read in Leviticus 19:12 that we are not to swear by my name, you shall not swear by my name falsely. There, see if I get it right this time. Nor shall you profane the name of the Lord, of your God. I am the Lord. So part of what's going on here is that someone who makes the promise, someone who does that here, needs to make sure that not only is it true, okay, and completely true, not only that, and that they're going to fulfill it, but also make sure that they're not asking God to attest anything that would be untrue, would be wrong, or be sinful in any way. So it's very important on how these things are done, and how one makes a vow, and one makes a promise, and how God is used when it is that that vow is made. Numbers 30 verse 2, it also shows us that someone may make a promise to God, they may do that, and whether they have it in writing or not, it is binding. It's binding according to all that has been said. If it comes out of the mouth, then it is binding on the one who promised it. I'm just going to go ahead and read it here and refer to it here. You can turn there if you want to, but in Deuteronomy 23, 21 through 23, I'm going to read this from the New International Version. But it reads, "If you make a vow to the Lord your God, do not be slow to pay it. For the Lord your God will certainly demand it of you, and you will be guilty of sin. But if you refrain from making a vow, you will not be guilty. Whatever your lips utter, you must be sure to do, because you made your vows freely to the Lord your God with your own mouth." I'm just going to go ahead and add one other reference here in Ecclesiastes 5, 4 through 6. You can jot that down if you'd like. But again, I'm going to read this from the New International Version. It just has a little more clarity to this. And it says, "When you make a vow to God, do not delay to fulfill it. He has no pleasures in fools. Fulfill your vow. It is better not to make a vow than to make one and not fulfill it. Do not let your mouth lead you into sin, and do not protest to the temple messenger, 'My vow was a mistake.' Why should God be angry at what you say? Why should he be angry at what you say and destroy the works of your hands?" You know, vows are a promise. They're a promise made to God. And commonly, as we read in Scripture, they come in the form of some kind of offering. They ask God to do something, some offering is promised, and when that occurs. But they are made voluntarily. But a vow once made must be kept. And if it comes out of the mouth, you know, whether someone else hears it or not, the promise is binding. And the real test, of course, is, does God hear that? What does God hear? And if so, and to the point, don't delay. Don't delay in fulfilling it. I recall a story of a husband and wife. They had decided that if God would help them sell a particular property they had been having difficulty in selling, that they would give a special offering, even though they knew that it would be selling the property at an amount much less than which they paid for it. But they made this vow. And they didn't do it on. They didn't have a contingency on it. They didn't specify that if they received a certain amount. They didn't do that. They said they're just really trying to get this property to sell. They asked God for help, and God blessed their request. He blessed it. Property did sell, and they did pay their vow when it went through. And in their mind, there's just no question whatsoever that God answered that prayer and honored that. Also, know someone who made a similar promise as it relates to a. Actually, in this case, it was a new business for which she was starting. He was just trying to get a few more customers, just trying to get it up to speed enough so that it actually could make a reasonable profit, actually. So what he did, though, is he made a specific vow that if God would provide a certain number of customers to him, in this case that meant contracts in his business, that he would fulfill this vow. And he did get more customers. Actually, he got more than he asked for. But unlike the other example, he kind of modified his vow as he went along, kind of postponed paying them, changed the terms, did those kinds of things. And in the end, unfortunate for him, it didn't go well for his business. Actually, his business ultimately failed. But you know, how God decides, you know, we don't control this, but how he decides to bless or correct someone, you know, in this regard, is his choosing, as well as the timing of that, and how he does that, and when he does that. But the law and the principles behind vows are very real. They're a very, very real principle. For when a vow is made, it openly or indirectly appeals to God to witness and to sanction what has been promised and to be the judge of the one vowing if they somehow breach that, if they don't do what they promised to do. You know, promise is a promise, and God sees all and he hears all. I'd like us to turn to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5. Throughout the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus focuses in on the spirit of the law, in keeping with its purpose, a reflection of God's character, his holy character, and these higher standards, if you will, that he asks us as followers of Christ to do, characteristics we're to reflect. But more than the letter, of course, we are to obey the spirit of the law. Let's go ahead and pick it up in verse 33 of Matthew chapter 5. We'll read 33 through 37. He says, "Again, you have heard that it was said of those of old, 'You shall not swear falsely, but shall perform your oath to the Lord.' But I say to you, do not swear at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is footstool, nor by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great King. Nor shall you swear by your head, because you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your yes be yes, and your no, no. For whatever is more than these is from the evil one." You know, some Christians have taken these verses to teach that we must not, under any circumstances, utter an oath or vow. Some refuse to take an oath in a marriage ceremony, for example, or in other situations. But is that the point here? Is that what is being taught? Is this a change to the law? Is it a change? Is it something new to overcome the human tendency to be less than truthful? Is it something new? Well, as we just read here, it's derived from the law as surely as the first two you have heard statements in his sermon, where he said, "You shall not commit murder. You shall not commit adultery." And it's to add some color here. We're going to go back a little bit earlier here in Matthew 5. Earlier in the Sermon on the Mount, he was very clear about what it is he was teaching. Let's go ahead and pick it up in verse 17 of Matthew 5. Again, these are familiar verses, but very important in the context here. It says, "Do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For assuredly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. Whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men, so shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." So by his own words, Jesus is making no change. He's making no change to the law. The word for fulfill is pleruo. It's pleruo. It means to verify. It means to shine a light on it. It means to make it clear, to clarify, to see it for what it truly is. So what is the point, though, that he's emphasizing? What is that? And what exactly were some of these scribes and Pharisees doing that are mentioned here? And what exactly are we to do that's different from what it is that they're doing? What's it supposed to be? Before we answer that, let's go ahead and hold our place, keep our place in Matthew 5, and let's go ahead and turn to James chapter 5. James chapter 5. Because James echoes the words that Jesus taught here, and he puts a special emphasis on this command. Actually, he introduces it with the words, "above all." James 5, verse 12. James 5, 12. He says, "But above all, my brethren, do not swear, either by heaven or by earth or with some other oath. Let your yes be yes and your no, no, lest you fall into judgment." Lest you fall into judgment. And we're going to a lot of word definitions here, but the word judgment in this verse is hypocrisis. It's hypocrisis. It means condemnation because of hypocrisy. Condemnation because of hypocrisy. And that's a really big hint about what Jesus was emphasizing as we go ahead and return back to Matthew chapter 5. Keep hypocrisy top of mind. Actually, I'm going to quote something here from Vines. Vines has a complete expository dictionary. It actually was referring, or does refer to oaths specifically mentioned here in Matthew 5:33. I'm going to go ahead and quote here. If you happen to have a copy of this at home, it's from page 438. But it says, "The Lord's command in Matthew 5:33 was a condemnation of the minute and arbitrary restrictions imposed by the scribes and Pharisees in the matters of adjurations, by which God's name was profaned. I have to admit, I had no idea what adjuration meant, so I had to go look it up. It means a solemn oath. A solemn oath. So God's name was profaned by how they administrated their oaths. And what was that about? You know, what was Jesus really teaching here? Well, he was addressing a popular abuse of oaths that were occurring in his day. In an attempt to protect God's name from being profaned by careless oath-breaking, common practice was to introduce substitute objects by which to swear by. For example, someone apparently thought it was harmless to swear an oath by something like their right arm or their right hand. They thought that was harmless. The idea being that the further removed the oath was from the actual name of God, the less danger they faced for violating it. And so what they did is they appointed people to arbitrate whether these oaths were real or not, whether they're truly binding or not. Did they refer to God or not? Indirectly refer to him. Where? How? It's kind of like our own court system. You know? All these different kinds of variations of oaths. Are they a real oath or are they not? Let's go ahead and turn to Matthew chapter 23. Oaths became almost like a competition. See who could bind the most impressive object to his statement to give them the greatest force while not mentioning God. And Jesus speaks of just how absurd this had all become. Matthew 23:16-22. It says, "Woe to you, blind guides, who say, whoever swears by the temple is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold in the temple, he is obliged to perform it. Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? And whoever swears by the altar, it is nothing, but whoever swears by the gift that is on it, he is obliged to perform it." He says, "Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift? Therefore he who swears by the altar swears by it and by all things on it. He who swears by the temple swears by it and by whom who dwells in it. And he who swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him who sits on it." So we can kind of see just where this had been taken and how Jesus just takes their logic and just turns their logic upside down. I mean, they were basically going through a bunch of mental acrobats to insulate themselves from accountability to God. And Jesus clearly states that nobody, you can't do that. You cannot isolate yourself from accountability to God by invoking things because God is sovereign over everything. You can't do that. You can't swear by the temple to avoid speaking words of truth. It's the glory of God that makes the temple what it is. You can't swear by heaven to avoid being seen or heard by God in your lies. Heaven is the very throne of God. So what Jesus was teaching is that all oaths invoke God's witness. They all do. Just as heaven, earth, and Jerusalem belong to God, so do the hairs in their head. And although we can dye our hair, I mean, if we have hair to dye, you know, we really cannot force it to be white, black. We have no control over that. We have no control over the aging process of our hair. Can't make one, like I said, one hair black or white, though people may try. But what is at the very core of all this is that oaths are a very poor substitute for integrity. And the point of these passages is just that, integrity. Since God witnesses everything, every word we say anyway, we should be able to tell the truth without having to call God to witness by a formal oath. That's the way it should be. And Jesus, of course, is using very, very forceful words here. Very forceful. Words that pierce, words that discern the reality of the situation, words that just compel us to think in ways very, very different than we would otherwise on our own. Pure yes, pure no, and anything in between doesn't belong. That's a hard thing to do. It's a hard thing. You know, as we read in places like Hebrews, I'm just going to refer to it here, Hebrews chapter 4, 12-13, it says, "For the word of God is living and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even the division of soul and spirit, and of joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. And there is no creature hidden from his sight, but all things are naked and open to the eyes of him to whom we must give account. And so God's word is compelling us here to seek the truth, to seek it, to tell it, to be truthful in mind and heart. Have no disconnect in truth, to keep our promises. And he clarifies that he sees everything, understands everything, understands it perfectly, and he sees truth perfectly. He sees it. A while back, I was reviewing a particular draft of a written contract after an agreement was reached between two parties. Unfortunately, that contract, at least as it was written in its draft form, it really wasn't even close to what was agreed upon. Language contained in the agreement, the document, had a lot of what I would refer to as escape clauses, had a lot of loose language that way. Common in agreements are things called quid pro quos, and that is if I do something, you do something, you know, contingent, those sorts of things. But if you look into the agreement, it was it's messy. It was subjectively perceived and ill-defined. It was just really hard to kind of get your arms around it. And they had all these other flowery language in the agreement, all these caveats that didn't make sense, all these odd stipulations, conditions, limitations, words that did not reconcile within the document. And then they had this whole thing, addendum, which was like several hundred pages, which was supposed to be clarifying all the messy language that was already in the rest of the agreement. Sorry, I'm going to get violent with the thing here. You're never coming back, Barry. Just control your violence. You can tell I'm getting excited about this. I spent hours on this agreement. But anyway, the contract, I'll kind of summarize a little bit here, basically said one party could do what they said they were going to do if they sort of felt like it. That's how loosely it was written. And frankly, it was impossible, at least for me, to really determine what they were really agreeing to do. You know, what was the truth? What was the yes? What was the no? It's kind of like I can't find it. I couldn't find it in there. It was too loose. And in this case, as the truth turns out, actually in the end, their purpose was actually not to come to an agreement at all. What they were trying to do is keep the negotiations in play long enough while they were getting a better deal from someone else. That's how it ended up. So, a whole lot of money wasted, a whole lot of legal fees, a lot of waste of time. A contract was never arrived to. We never got there. But you know, oaths, you know, when formalized or even in the process of negotiation, as this story shows, are nothing without integrity. They are nothing without that. You know, with that in mind, let's go ahead and turn to Matthew. We're going to return there to Matthew 5. I'm going to go ahead and just read the first part of verse 34 and then verse 37 again. It says, "But I say to you, do not swear at all, but let your yes be yes and your no, no," verse 37, "for whatever is more than these is from the evil one," whatever is more. So just to kind of summarize what we've talked about so far, when you swore an oath to someone, you are appealing to that person as a witness to attest to your words and a judge against you if your words are found to be untrue. You're invoking both. You were using that name, using the name of someone whose witness was reliable, someone who was trustworthy, to testify that your words were trustworthy and they're good. And at the same time, you were acknowledging this accountability to that person, agreeing that you expected it. You expected to be judged by that person if you were found to be speaking falsely. You expected that. You know, that's why we have read in places like Hebrews 6, verse 16, it references men swear by one greater than themselves. And again, they are swearing by the one to whom they are accountable, the one they made the promise to. And in Jesus' day, an interesting twist was put on all this. They had trouble telling the truth consistently, as is common in today's society, today's world. So in order to guard themselves against being found guilty of swearing falsely by the name of God, it seems that they would swear by anything other than God in order to try to escape that. They wanted to add some kind of force to their promises. They wanted to sound credible. They wanted to be believed. They wanted those sorts of things. But they didn't want to incur the judgment of God by swearing by his name. when they really didn't intend to make good on their promise. They were really intended to. And it was not entirely true, whatever promise they were making. So they created what was basically a lesser class of oaths, sub-oaths. You can think of a lot of different ways to describe them. You can think of them as half-truths, semi-truths, things like white lies, you know, commitments with escape clauses, or what I like to refer to as the fractional truth. It's not the whole truth. It's not whole. There may be some truth in it, maybe some, but it's not the whole truth. It's not. And this, as Jesus referred to in Matthew 5:37, is from the evil one. That is from the evil one. You know, John 8:4 is very clear about this, about where departures come from. I'm just going to read it here, John 8:44, where it says, "You are of your father, the devil, and desires of your father you want to do. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth." He doesn't stand in that area. That's not where he is. That's not who he is. And it says, "Because there is no truth in him." There is no truth in him. "When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it." And what Jesus is teaching here, and to the point, he says there is only one class of truth. There is only one truth. There's only one class of promise. There's not these gray areas. There's not these fractional promises. He says, that does not come from me. That doesn't come from me. That has a lie in it. A portion, at least a portion, has a lie. And he says, that's not me. That's not me. Remember back, just thinking of some stories too, as I was thinking back to my own, oh, shall I say, lessons I've had to learn over time about stuff like this. Actually, I'm going to use an example of a friend of mine, although I could have just as easily used one of my own in many regards, but I want to use the specific example. Back in my college days, I had a bunch of friends that I hung out with, and we played football together. We did all sorts of things. We had a lot in common and always a joy to hang out together. But I would say what we did not have in common was our driving habits. Very, very different. Some of us were just a lot more conservative, shall we say, at least with things like, you know, speed limits, using blinkers on the highway when you go between lanes, passing on the correct side of the road, you know, that sort of thing. And others had different habits. They were different. And one of them, we're just going to call him Joe, for anonymity's sake. He was sort of a guy who thought that traffic rules were more or less a suggestion. Broad and loose suggestion of what reasonable driving habits were, what they should be. And on one particular day, he decided to pass a car on a two-lane highway, which of itself is no big deal. However, the oncoming traffic on this particular day just never provided an opening for him to pass. So what he decided to do was pass on the right side, okay, on the shoulder of the road, which was illegal in the state. Of course, all the while going over 75 miles an hour in a 50. He's come blazing by, and so as he goes by, he has two of his tires are on that pavement on the shoulder, and two of them are in the dirt and the gravel on the right. And as he's going by, of course, he doesn't have very good control. He's swerving, he's fishtailing, car's about to lose control, but as it turns out, he was able to regain control just enough time to hop right back on the highway before there was a bridge. And of course, all the while, a police officer was coming down the other way. The ticket, and he did receive one, was for reckless driving. Reckless driving. And given his driving record, it would have meant that he would lose his license. He would lose it. Unless he was at least successful in reducing it to what is called a negligent charge. In this particular case, he would have received a very, very big fine, but still be able to keep his driver's license. But in order to do that, he had to contest it in court. Had to go to court. So the date arrived. Court date. Some of the guys accompanied him, wanted to see what would happen. I mean, after all, he may not be able to drive home from that. So anyway, some of us went. Well, the judge knew him by name from the last time he was in court. And so this little interesting dialogue starts to ensue. He says, "I see you are visiting us again, Joe." Joe's a little like dog with his tail behind his legs. "Yes, Your Honor." "Yeah. Joe, didn't you promise me in this courtroom that you wouldn't be seeing me again? Yes, Your Honor, that is what I was hoping for. And yet you're here today. You're here with a ticket for reckless driving, no less. What exactly do you wish to share with the court? Well, Joe sort of indicates that he wanted to share some details on the event, but the judge cut him off. He says, Joe, the officer's report shows clearly you're going over 75 in a posted 50, passing a vehicle on the right. You're nearly lost control of your vehicle. What on earth could you possibly say on your behalf? And he's basically sitting there kind of quiet. He says, well, Your Honor, all of that is true. He figured out he wasn't going to be able to get past that. He says, but I have to say, I really wasn't in a reckless mood at the time. I was much more in a negligent mood. And we're watching. Is he going to buy that? And Joe, once again, with great passion and trying to put on clothed in humility, went on to promise, but Your Honor, I promise I will be a responsible driver. I know what I did was wrong, and he did all those kinds of things, and we're just watching this and wondering if the judge was actually going to buy this. And, well, the judge ended up being lenient. He ended up being lenient, and he did drop it to a negligent designation, accompanied with a heavy fine, like I said earlier, and a very stiff warning. This is it. I will not be lenient next time. Next time, the license goes, period. And for those of us who knew Joe, you know, we didn't really think that his promises really held to his intentions. He just related what he thought the judge wanted to hear. Whatever it took, whatever promise it took to be able to keep his license active. And I believe he would have said as much if we cornered him on it. Though in the course of time, he, like a lot of us, learned lessons in life, and he became a responsible driver and that sort of thing over the course of time. But in the context of what we're talking about here today, even though this was in a court of law, even though he had sworn to tell the truth, even though there's that, it's still likened to this partial truth, this fractional truth, these half-truths, these things that Jesus is talking about. It's not the real truth. It's not really true. It's not a real promise. And he says, this is not yes, yes, and no, no. This is in the middle ground. Yeah. It doesn't come from him. And my purpose is not to single Joe out at all. Like I said, when I started this story, I could share many of my own things for which I said things that I should not have in my life. So I don't mean to pick on him whatsoever. But I am trying to say is that this is where the adversary wants us to play around in. Partial truths. Partial truths. But it does beg the question, too. It does beg a question. What if you are trying to be truthful? What if you are trying to do the right thing? What if you're trying to speak truthfully, to be honest, and you are trying to make promises that you fully intend to keep? What if you do that? What if you do that, but something does happen? What if something comes up that may require a change of your plan? What if your yes is yes and your no is no, but there is a legitimate circumstance that comes up and your yes cannot be your yes? It has to be a no. Well, there is an example shared by the Apostle Paul, and it speaks to this kind of thing occurring. Let's go ahead and turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 1. 2 Corinthians chapter 1. Fascinating passage here in light of what we read in Matthew chapter 5. Because here, Paul acknowledges that our yes must be yes, and our no, no, and yet he employs an oath to affirm the genuineness of his motivation for changing his plans, because he does change his plans here. 2 Corinthians chapter 1, let's pick it up in verse 16. He says, to pass by way of you to Macedonia, to come again from Macedonia to you, and be helped by you on the way to Judea. Therefore, when I was planning this, did I do it lightly? Or the things I plan, do I plan according to the flesh, that with me there should be yes, yes, and no, no? But God is faithful. Our word to you was not yes and no. We'll go ahead and skip down to verse 23. It says, moreover, I call God as witness against my soul, that to spare you, I came no more to Corinth. To spare you. So here Paul explains to the folks in Corinth, the church in Corinth, that he had genuinely intended to visit them. Actually, visit them twice. He promised to do that on his way from Ephesus to Macedonia, and then on his way back, his return trip. But his plans had changed. And the reason he did not come back to Corinth, to read here, is that he had come to the realization that to do that would have somehow caused them pain or grief. It would have hurt them in some way. So was Paul somehow violating Christ's teaching? Was he doing that? I'd like us to turn to James chapter 4. James chapter 4. We're going to get a little more perspective on this issue and a little bit of a window into the principle that Paul is teaching and dealing with here as he has changed his plans. You know, as we just read, Paul did not come back to Corinth as his return trip would have hurt the people in some way. But here in James 4, we actually see a negative example that illustrates the right perspective for which we're to have. Let's go ahead and pick it up in verse 13 of James chapter 4. We'll read 13 through 17. He says, come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell, and make a profit. Whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills. If the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. But now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin. You know, our promises are to be seen through this lens of submitting always to God's will. And we can act in good faith, and we should act in good faith, to promise something, but we may literally be unable to fulfill it. And as he just mentioned here in the example, I mean, we don't know how long we're going to live. We don't know that. We don't have that visibility. We may not be able to fulfill a particular promise because of that. We may not. But rather, what is being taught here is that we have to humbly approach those commitments. It's not that we're not to make them, but we should approach them in such a way that we know that we're not in control. I can't control certain things. And if somehow those promises prevent us from doing the right thing, of doing good, as we read in verse 17, doing the right thing, we may need to make a course correction. We may need to do that. You know, God is not saying here that, hey, we can use any frivolous excuse to get out of something. Not at all. But he wants us to be truthful in our promises and understand that we always need to submit to his will and his correction and be willing to do that. You know, Paul came to this realization somehow as he was anticipating his visit, at least at that particular time. He knew it wasn't the best thing to do. Somehow it was going to cause more harm than good. And so he declared before God that he was doing this change and the reasoning for it. And he was not going against Jesus Christ's teaching when he did it, regarding yes being yes and no being no. And you know, you think about it, we might have to give one another a little bit of latitude when it comes to things like that. You know, is this passage telling us to just unquestionably hold one another's feet to the fire if we make a promise? That there's no room for change? No way. If you make a promise and you violate it, you're the worst offender? Or is it telling us to, you know, raise doubts about someone's character, and if they ask us for a little bit of forbearance because there's some kind of conflict that came up with what they intended to do? Or perhaps maybe it's actually asking us something very different, to really look at the unseen log in our eye before it is that we look at the potential speck in theirs. You know, but what the context here is teaching us, if the Lord wills, if the Lord wills, is the statement that we're to remember in the context of us fulfilling our promises as well. We make them in good faith, but we make them with this understanding that we do not control everything. We don't control everything. When reading about Paul's situation here in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, I just had a couple examples, I remember, that came to mind, because I could see where he was coming from. I just thought of a time several years ago, a friend had promised me that he was going to come over and help me barbecue for a large group. I mean, it would be difficult for one of us to do it, so he was really kind and agreed to come over and do that with me. And he was going to bring his barbecue too, so it's going to be a big cookout. Well, at the last minute, he backed out. And he was well enough to physically do it. He could have done that, but what happened is that he believed he was still viral from a cold and flu bug he'd been fighting. So did he break his promise? Well, yeah. Yeah, he did. But did he do the right thing in breaking his promise? I absolutely believe he did. I think he did. You know, his promise is based on him doing the best he can, as much as depends on him, but his promise is also based on doing what is best overall there as well. And his coming would have likely caused a lot more harm than good. Probably would have infected a lot of people, made them sick. You know, we're human. We are human. And when we make promises, we have to do this from the perspective, as we just read, as the Lord wills. If the Lord wills, we have to be able to do that. Also, remember someone telling me of a dinner party, actually, they had organized at their home after services some time ago, many, many years ago, decades ago, actually. In anticipation of that dinner party, they had invited two families to come over and join them, and who had promised to come. Well, interestingly, both families actually canceled just a day before, on the Friday, simply saying that something had come up and they needed to change their plans. Well, as a result of those cancellations, these folks had, they went to services and they went to go try to invite some other people over. I mean, they had prepared all this food. It was easy to accommodate others. But instead, as they were attempting to do that, someone else invited them over to their home. So they thought, oh, okay, well, it's all right. We can put the stuff in the freezer. We'll go do this later. Well, guess who was at the home they were invited to? Oh, yeah. Both families. The words bad form or awkward mean anything to you? Well, was there a promise that was broken? Yeah, promise was broken. Did the parents of these families do the right thing in breaking that promise? Well, I don't think so. I don't think so. And so it was an awkward dinner party. There was a lot of tension between people, and there was some fallout afterwards. It took time for people to appropriately apologize and for forgiveness to be given and the sting of the memory to kind of go away. But you know, promises are an important thing. How they're handled are very important. And God's very specific about how they're handled if there ever does come a place where there's a breach. There has to be. Again, as God wills. Let's go ahead and turn to Luke chapter 16. You know, being truthful matters. Our yeses matter, as do our noes. Even in what may seem as the little things, the smaller things. And there's a critical point that Jesus makes in the parable of the unjust servant that speaks to this very, very clearly. Luke 16, verse 10. I'm going to go ahead and read this from the New Living Translation. I liked how this came out with that. Luke 16, verse 10. It says, "If you are faithful in little things, you will be faithful in large ones. But if you are dishonest in little things, you won't be honest with greater responsibilities." And he's teaching this principle that we're to be faithful in everything. Faithful in all things, large or small, in all our promises. Now, if we gave it some thought, each of us could probably come up with some things in our own mind, perhaps assign some things that we would consider to be big faithful items, versus maybe things we might think of as a little less than that or smaller ones. What constitutes that? But if we were to take, for example, the marriage covenant, I think we would all agree. I would hope we'd all agree. It's a very sacred matter. It's a big thing. Big thing about being faithful. And in a wedding, many people refer to the words exchanged as wedding vows, which is true. But actually, they can be vows and oaths. You know, promises made between the spouses, as well as promises made from the spouses to God. It's one of the few, actually, formal covenants that we still practice in our culture. God singles it out over and over in His Word as a covenant unlike any other. He's the one who declares it to be, for example, a picture of the relationship between Christ and His church. He's the one who declares it to be a sacred bonding of two into one flesh. Before His eyes or in His eyes. He's the one who says, "What God has joined together, let no man tear asunder." Yet, as we read about being faithful in the little things, godliness compels us to honor our statements even if they seem small, trivial, inconsequential. But you think about it here, as it relates to the marriage covenant, for example, if we were to take that as an example, think about how this would be, though, if one spouse, if the spouses, are faithful, they're both faithful in their marriage, yeah, let's just pretend that one of them here for a moment doesn't keep much of their promises and the little things. How's that going to work out? You know, what if they promise to pick up the kids after school, but they're just unreliable? What if things like that happen? What do they say they're going to keep within the budget, but they spend outside of it anyway? You know, let's say, for example, like the Heidemans over here, that they had an agreement, 7 years of plenty here, sweetie, and 7 years of something else, and they agreed on a plan. And that was a great example, by the way, but that's a great example of this, too, because that's what budgeting's about. It's being able to run your finances a certain way in anticipation of a future we don't know everything about. Very much, very important. But what if one of them was really good about that? The other one just refused. They just didn't. They just think faithful in those things. They just constantly spend outside of it. What if you have that in your marriage? What if one of them says, I'm going to spend quality time with you, but they never get around to it? Never quite get around to it. Well, does that allow a marriage to work? Does that allow a big, faithful thing to work when the little things are not being taken care of? And part of the teaching here, Christ is saying this, is it doesn't. It just doesn't. And the point here is that the character of a godly person does not make light of that. They don't make light of the smaller promises or the large. They don't make light of either of them. And they all do the right thing. And Christ is teaching us, do the right thing, whether it's difficult, whether it's inconvenient, and even if it is to your own hurt, do the right thing. Let's go and turn to Psalm chapter 15. Psalm 15, here a question is posed. Actually, the question is that who may dwell with the Lord? You know, who will get to be in the kingdom as one of his eternal children? And it answers the question of what character the faithful possess. Psalm 15, let's pick it up in verse 1. It says, Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle? Who may dwell in your holy hill? He who walks uprightly and works righteousness and speaks the truth in his heart. He speaks the truth. He's true. He makes promises. He keeps them. It's part of who he is. Skipping down to verse 4. He says, in whose eyes a vile person is despised, but he honors those who fear the Lord. He who swears to his own hurt and does not change. Doesn't change. In the introduction, we reviewed some of the court protocols in swearing somebody in to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And I asked the question, does any of it really make people any more truthful? You know, does it? You know, might it compel someone who takes the stand? Might it compel them to think twice about what they say, their testimony? Might it prompt them to endeavor to make good on a promise to tell the truth? It might. It might for somebody. It might very well make them think twice. But that is beside the point that God is making. He's saying it should make no difference whatsoever. At all. According to God, any formal oath or vow should simply mirror the yes or no that comes from a heart of truth. Not the formality of it. And in concluding his statement about oaths on the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, but let your yes be yes, and your no, no, for whatever is more than these, whatever is more, anything between these, is from the evil one. It doesn't come from him. You know, as mentioned earlier in the sermon, some of the scribes and Pharisees had systematically confused this teaching. How they administrated it. Their oaths were no more reliable than the statement of a kid with his fingers behind his back that are crossed. Because in their hearts, they were more interested in being believed than in being truthful. And more to the point, they're more interested in being believed than being godly. Our yes must be yes and our no must be no. And no oath of itself can make that so. Can't. And in that sense, being believed really is nothing. A truthful person in the eyes of God, our Heavenly Father, is everything. That's what's important. If we were to read a little farther into the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus tells us in verse 48, of Matthew chapter 5 to be perfect. Be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect. You know, and it would be easy to kind of point the fingers or point a finger at the scribes and the Pharisees that Jesus was sharing, their example that he refers to here, seeing just how ridiculous, you know, the reasoning was, and then kind of pat ourselves in the back. You know, look at them. Glad I'm not one of them. But really, I mean, be a bit short-sighted. Because it's so easy to be between the yes and the no. It is so easy. And Jesus tells us that this is a matter of your heart. It's a matter of your heart. Yes should be yes, simply. No should be no. And we should be people of our word, that we should keep our promises. Should be able to do that. And that the truth is a fundamental standard, really, by which we as God's people demonstrate his character. Because everything he says is true. In conclusion, I just want to go ahead and read Ephesians 4:15. I'm going to read this from the English Standard Version. And it says, Speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ. So brethren, you know, may our yes be yes, and our no be no. And maybe be people who tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, always.